From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, 250,000 years of history in an ice core. We talk with Paul Majewski, chief scientist with the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. They're able to pinpoint the start of the Industrial Revolution and the end of the Ice Age because the ice traps atmospheric changes. The layers of ice tell stories, like the rings of bark around a tree. Also, we talk with children's book illustrator Ted Lewin about his unlikely first career as a pro wrestler. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Dangerous Woman, starring Deborah Winger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Several government reports issued today suggest the economy is gaining momentum. Most dramatic was a big drop in the unemployment rate in November. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The unemployment rate fell sharply to 6.4%. It's the lowest level in almost 3 years. Businesses reported there were 208,000 jobs added to payrolls. The job growth was broad-based. Most welcome were 30,000 new manufacturing jobs. It was the second straight month of job growth in that sector. Economists found little to fault in the report, though they're divided over whether it's a sign the economy will continue to strengthen into the new year. Those who believe it will had their argument bolstered by a 0.5% jump in the October Index of Leading Indicators, which predicts economic activity 6 to 9 months down the road. It was the third consecutive monthly increase in the index. Also today, a report that orders to U.S. factories increased 1.2% in October, with orders for aircraft and automobiles leading the way. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
North Korea has accused the Clinton administration of being trigger-happy for talking about building up American forces in South Korea. The North Korean government said that U.S. military pressure could push the two sides to the brink of war over the North's refusal to allow international inspections of its nuclear program. President Clinton and other administration officials have insisted that military talks with South Korea are part of normal procedure, but they've refused to rule out an increase in U.S. forces in the South. Despite its tough talk, North Korea also said today that it's preparing to release more remains of Americans missing during the Korean War. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is in Israel at the start of a week-long visit to the Middle East that may involve some shuttle diplomacy. It's part of an effort to revive peace talks between Israel and Syria. Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Peace talks between Israel and Syria are deadlocked, and the Israelis don't seem to mind. They are concentrating on negotiations with the Palestinians, which have run into their own problems. Some Israeli officials have even suggested they aren't all that happy to see Christopher at this time. American officials traveling with the secretary say he will offer Syrian President Hafez al-Assad a meeting with President Clinton in exchange for a letter of intent to make peace with Israel. Christopher will travel to Damascus next week. He'll also visit Jordan, Egypt, and Tunisia, and will meet with PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat at least once. The Palestinians want United States help in breaking their impasse with Israel. But Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said Israel and the Palestinians must solve their differences without outside assistance. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The Dow Industrials gained 2 points today to close at 3,704. This is NPR. Colombian gangster Pablo Escobar was buried today in Medellin, the city he made the headquarters of one of the biggest cocaine trafficking operations in the world. Escobar, who'd been a fugitive for 16 months, was killed yesterday by police and soldiers who traced him to a hideout in the city. Colombian officials said that Escobar was killed in a shootout as he tried to escape. Dr. Jack Kevorkian is in day 4 of a hunger strike in a county jail outside Detroit. Meanwhile, Kevorkian's attorney says another doctor is interested in carrying on Kevorkian's work. Don Gagne reports.
Kevorkian has refused all solid food since being jailed this past Monday in Oakland County, Michigan. He's refused to post a $50,000 bond and has consumed only water, juice, and vitamins. The 65-year-old retired pathologist is accused of breaking a state law banning assisted suicide. He has now been charged 3 separate times under that law. Kevorkian is being kept in a cell away from the general jail population. His condition is being monitored by doctors who say he has lost some weight but is doing okay. His attorney, meanwhile, says if Kevorkian doesn't survive his fast, then another doctor has expressed an interest in taking over Kevorkian's crusade of helping sick people take their own lives. The doctor, who is not from Michigan, has not been identified. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Newspaper reports from Northern California say that two seventh-grade girls have identified the man police say is the main suspect in the abduction of 12-year-old Polly Kloss. The two girls were at a slumber party at the Kloss house in Petaluma 2 months ago when Polly was kidnapped. The reports differ as to whether the girls positively identified Richard Allen Davis. Davis is a 39-year-old prison parolee with two prior kidnapping convictions. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The last place you're likely to see Paul Maievski is in a warm tropical climate. He's attracted to the cold, the really cold. Maievski is one of the few people who can rightly call themselves a glaciologist, and he spent many years doing research in remote places like Antarctica, the Himalayas, Greenland. He has found that ice is a reliable frozen library of information about past climate changes. By drilling into ice cores and analyzing ice samples, Maievski and his team have been able to gather a historical record of past ice ages, volcanic eruptions, warming trends, and more. This summer, Maievski spent 5 months in Greenland, where he directs the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. His team has been able to bore into the ice there and retrieve samples that go back 250,000 years. Greenland is a fertile site for this work because of the depth of the glaciers and the temperature. Even in the dead of summer, it never goes above freezing. Maievski and his co-workers have a sophisticated laboratory on the ice in Greenland, and in spite of having to wear thick gloves, thermal boots, and plenty of layers, they can do a lot of sophisticated research on site. The drill they use is about 100 feet high and is housed in a 52-foot diameter dome.
If you can imagine, it's sort of a corkscrew, and we basically screw it down into the ice. It collects a 5.2-inch diameter core, which is as long as 20 feet. And once we've filled the barrel up with approximately 20 feet of ice, we pull it back up to the surface. It's on a very, very long cable, and put it onto a horizontal position, and then extrude or push out the core. And at that point, we begin to make a lot of the preliminary measurements on the core.
How far down have you been able to drill? What's the farthest you've been able to go?
Well, we actually have the world record in terms of depth of ice, which is an important fact for us, because it also means, more importantly, that we have the oldest and longest record in the world. We were able to drill down. The exact depth in meters is 3053.44 meters. It's a little bit over 11,000 feet.
Okay, 11,000 feet, and how far back in time does that take you?
That 11,000 feet takes us back probably something close to 250,000 years. We have a great deal of confidence in being able to date the first 90 to 100,000 years of the record, because we actually see annual markers, which we've been able to count down as you would count tree rings down. When we get to the lower part of the core, approximately the lower 200 meters or about 650, 700 feet, much of the remaining 150,000 years is squashed down in that lower portion of the core. So it becomes a little bit harder to tell the exact age.
You have described these samples of ice as being like the Rosetta Stone. What kind of secrets are embedded in the ice?
Well, it's an amazing record. It's an potentially a very, very vivid, robust record of what our paleo environment has been. And we're able to, by measuring as many as 42 different parameters in any one sample and doing this at very, very high resolution, great detail, and doing it continuously down the record, we're able to capture a great deal of information about what the atmosphere was comprised of, what the winds were like, what the temperatures were like. We can, for all purposes, draw a very, very vivid picture of the paleo environment.
Can you, though, generalize from the ice in Greenland to climatic conditions in more temperate climates or even in tropical climates?
The record in central Greenland is certainly telling us something about the atmosphere throughout a very, very large portion of the Arctic and probably throughout a great portion of the North Atlantic region. It does not necessarily tell us what was going on in the tropics, although with a very, very solid understanding of what went on in the Arctic, which tends to be, in terms of change in climate, a far more dynamic region, we could make some very, very good educated guesses about what the more temperate or tropical latitudes were doing. The way we get answers about the temperate and tropical latitudes is by collecting ice cores at very, very high elevations in Asia, which we can then calibrate or correlate back to the records in the polar regions like Greenland or Antarctica.
What then can you tell us about environmental conditions 250,000 years ago, looking either at the Arctic or looking at the North Atlantic region?
Perhaps the most remarkable thing that we found from our records is the fact that the last 10,000 years of Earth history, a time period which has seen the major growth in civilization, was a relatively mild and relatively stable period compared to the last 250,000 years. If we go back prior to our relatively warm time period, which is called an interglacial, a time between glacials, we find that the climate seems to, at least based on our ice core record, the climate in the North Atlantic and throughout the Arctic fluctuated very, very wildly. There would have been extremely strong winds that would have perhaps affected a region for several years and then suddenly stopped for a while. Temperature variations would have been very, very dramatic. In a word, it was a very, very tumultuous environment compared to the one that we live in today.
Do you know why there has been climatic stability in the last 10,000 years, though?
I'd say preliminarily, it's because of the fact that over the last 10,000 years, we have not had extensive ice cover over portions of North America and Europe. And because we haven't had that extensive ice cover, it means that the air masses which move over the northern hemisphere have not had large, white, slippery surfaces in which they can effectively pick up wind speed and also deviate in terms of their latitudinal position quite easily. So it's probably the presence of large ice sheets more than 10,000 years ago that created the instability. So, of course, the next question one asks oneself is why were the large ice sheets there prior to 10,000 or 11,000 years ago and not today? And perhaps the best good general answer is the relationship between the Earth and the Sun changes on a periodic basis. And when the Sun is relatively closer to the Earth in general terms, we have less likely conditions for glacier growth. And when the Sun is relatively far from the Earth, we have good conditions. And there are tens of thousands of year cycles which the Sun and Earth go through, changing their relative position.
I want to make sure I understand then the climatic changes or the instability that occurred more than 10,000 years ago. Do you see this as a result of the Earth's relationship to the Sun, or were there other things at work here on Earth?
There are a whole range of things that control climate. Perhaps one of the primary things is the relationship between the Earth and the Sun. It definitely sets the major stage for climate. It plunges the surface of the Earth into gradually cooler time periods or gradually warmer time periods. And it may very well explain the overall growth and decay of the very, very massive ice sheets that cover the northern hemisphere or large portions of the northern hemisphere. After that, however, there are a whole range of other things or factors which control climate. And they include things such as greenhouse gases. Increases in greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, tend to trap heat at the surface of the Earth. Volcanic explosions give off both dust and also gases which tend to shield incoming radiation. And there are a whole range of so-called forcing or climate forcing factors, and many of those we are actually able to measure in our ice core. So the remarkable thing about the ice core record is the fact that we not only have a detailed, vivid history of what the environment was, but we also were able to measure many of the things which can potentially cause the change in the climate.
What does a volcanic explosion look like in an ice core?
A volcanic explosion in an ice core is usually marked either by an ash layer. This is the particles that are thrown up by very explosive volcanoes, or by an increase in sulfuric acid because of the sulfur gases that are given off by the volcano. As of the last few decades, there's been an immense amount of interest in this, certainly recently because of Pinatubo, several years ago because of El Chichon. And we now know that it's primarily the gas, the sulfur gas, that's given off by these volcanoes that gets into the atmosphere, gets converted to sulfuric acid, and is very, very effective in shielding incoming radiation.
Can you see the start of the Industrial Revolution looking at the ice core?
Yes. That's an excellent question. We've been able to see very, very solid evidence for the onset of the Industrial Revolution using several different types of measurements. Perhaps the most precise of all of the measurements, again, is sulfuric acid. Volcanoes are not the only source of sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. It also comes from various biological organisms will give it off, particularly from the ocean, but also from the land. And as of about the last 100 years, in fact, beginning literally at the turn of the century, we see tremendous increases in sulfur dioxide measured in our core as sulfuric acid, which were produced by human activity, industrialization. And we not only see the start of this humanly produced pollution, but we can also see increases and decreases in the level of it, which mark very, very closely, or I should say parallel very, very closely, what we do know about emissions coming from factories, particularly coal-burning plants. And perhaps the most important thing is the fact that we not only see these oscillations in sulfuric acid in the Greenland ice core being produced by industry effectively turning up and turning down its coal burning, but we also see the effect of the Clean Air Act, which as of the early 1970s, in our particular record, shows that there was not the there was actually a leveling out of the pollution or the sulfuric acid that was contributed to the Greenland ice sheet from North American sources. So it's a very, very sensitive indicator, but it is only one of the indicators that we have of human activity.
We're going to take a very short break. My guest is Paul Majewski. He's a glaciologist and director of the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. We're talking about his research in Greenland, research looking at climate and climate change. He's also a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences and the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at the University of New Hampshire. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is glaciologist Paul Majewski. What is the evidence that you're seeing of global warming? And as you mentioned earlier, there's a debate, I guess, back and forth whether we're in a warming trend or not. What does the ice tell you?
I think that perhaps before thinking, or I should say discussing global warming, perhaps the best thing to do is to define what is actually implied by global warming. I think in general we think of the term global warming because it has warming in it as implying that temperatures will increase in the future largely because of the increased production of greenhouse gases, which are directly tied to population and combustion of fossil fuels. As it turns out, that may very well be the case. There are an awful lot of indications from a variety of records all over the world suggesting that temperatures are rising, but they don't necessarily rise everywhere. the same amount, and they don't necessarily have to rise constantly. And I say that because we can very often counteract the effects of global warming or temperature increase by, for example, increasing the amount of sulfur dioxide as a pollutant in the atmosphere. So we have an interesting seesaw type of effect. The more we pollute the environment with acid rain, the more we may be able to cool off various portions of the environment. That's a poor trade-off. That's just the temperature part of global warming. I think the correct term is that we should be worrying about global change, which is not just a temperature increase in some parts of the world, but it will be, without a doubt, a dramatic change in climate in general. And I can even use the word dramatic because we know that there are both naturally occurring dramatic changes in climate and also humanly potentially humanly produced dramatic changes in climate. So that means that not only should we be looking at potential changes in temperature, but also wind speed, precipitation, dryness, humidity, on and on.
So from what you're learning from examining the ice core in Greenland, what concerns do you have about environmental conditions today?
Well, I can answer that best by giving you one small example of something that we found in central Greenland and then tracked to a much larger area. The Chernobyl event of the mid-1980s, that it was a disastrous event in terms of population and in terms of the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. From a scientific point of view, it provided us, although it was a very unfortunate event, it did provide us with a radioactive marker, which allowed us to trace the distribution of the Chernobyl fallout throughout the Arctic. And many scientists found evidence of this in the Greenland ice sheet, throughout all of the snowpacks in northern Scandinavia, on and on and on. But 18 months after the Chernobyl event, we were down at the South Pole in Antarctica, and we were digging a snow pit there. And when we came back to the laboratory, we analyzed that record, and we were able to find evidence of Chernobyl having traveled all the way to the South Pole. It was not at the radioactive levels were certainly not high enough to be of any danger whatsoever, but it did act as an excellent marker. And what it demonstrates is that even very, very small sources, and relatively in a global scale, the Chernobyl event was a very short event, and it came from a very, very small source, can make their way, in many cases, throughout the entire globe. So that tells us that the climate and the atmosphere is very, very sensitive, even to small changes.
From the ice records that you've been able to gather, can you make any predictions about the future?
One of the things we would dearly like to do is to be able to make a prediction about the future. And we can't do that right now, but I really do think that we will be able to make a very significant contribution to our understanding of future climate within a very short period of time. And I say that with some confidence because we have at our disposal now a time machine, the most detailed record of paleoclimate, paleoatmosphere, paleoenvironment that has ever been created. What we can do with this record and what we are doing right now, and it'll take us a couple more years because we need to analyze many more samples that we've recovered this year, is to understand as well as we can, make a giant step forward in our understanding of how climate works and whether or not there are cycles in climate, whether or not these cycles are simple or not. Once we understand the pattern of climate, we should be able to predict what natural climate would have done if it had not been for humans entering the scene in an industrial sense in the last 100 to 150 years.
Let me ask you about some of the conditions that you work in up in Greenland. I know you've worked in the Himalayas. You've also worked down in Antarctica. Is it a difficult transition for you to live both in New Hampshire, as you do, and to move into these very remote, distant regions of the world?
Perhaps the most honest way to answer that is to say yes. Whenever we make this sort of transition, the first few days are very difficult. It's it's wonderful to be home, but it's certainly strange to be back in a warm environment. If we've been working in Greenland, we come back from very cold temperatures, sometimes to be greeted by a heat wave, and even more strangely, to be greeted by darkness, which is something that you can is a great shock to your system. It's as big a shock coming back to darkness.
Do you change your diet at all when you're living completely in a cold environment?
Yes. In fact, diet is perhaps one of the great pleasures of being in these very, very cold environments, because we eat anything between 6 and 10,000 calories a day in order to keep warm, and that isn't necessarily because we're moving or traveling a lot. You burn up a great deal of energy just trying to stand in one place, which we sometimes have to do when we're processing the core.
Do you miss the night?
No, not at all.
Why
miss a
not?
Lot of things when I leave, but I don't miss the night. It's a great experience being able to live in a place that's light all the time. Many of us seem to have a lot more energy. Given my choice, I'd live in a place that was 24 hours of daylight all year round. It would mean a great deal of moving from the northern to the southern hemisphere, but I think it's certainly a preferable situation.
You work in very remote parts of the world. Is this dangerous work that you do?
It certainly is work that, in terms of danger, it's work that one has to take very, very seriously. I've been doing this work for 25 years, and I've led a great number of expeditions, and safety is the most important thing that that we think about. Number one is safety, and number two is making sure that that the people involved in these programs are doing well emotionally. The science is very, very important, but it follows right on track with those first two.
Have you had some close calls?
Certainly everybody in this sort of business has experienced very, very serious storms. We've been in storms in the Antarctic in our tents that are over 100 miles per hour, and you always feel as if you're on the edge when you're in a little piece of canvas with some metal poles, experiencing the equivalent of a freight train coming by every now and then for several days. Sometimes the snowstorms are extremely intense. There are whiteout conditions when you literally can't see your finger 3 inches away from your eyes. There are, in some areas, the danger of avalanche and crevasses. So there are times when suddenly you feel very unsure of the situation. But that's why you surround yourself with a good team of people. And usually what happens is if one person begins to feel that way, the others don't feel that way, at least temporarily. And as a group, you keep yourselves nice and calm.
You've been able to look back some 250,000 years or so. Do you have fantasies about a favorite year?
Actually, in a way, yes. I'm particularly interested in being able to pick some interesting time periods. For example, the sinking of the Spanish Armada in the early 1500s was a major turning point in the wars between the Spanish and the British. And that the sinking occurred, I believe, during a time when the Spanish were about to attack the British and they were caught in a terrible storm. It would be very, very interesting to find out, to document that storm in our ice core, which I think we can do, and then find out, was this a time period when there were many, many storms, or was it simply a freak accident that the Spanish were caught in and it effectively changed history? There are many interesting associations between dramatic changes in history and dramatic changes in climate.
Thank you very much for talking to us today and telling us about your work. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
Paul Majewski teaches at the University of New Hampshire. Next week, he'll present his findings from his Greenland research at the meeting of the Geophysical Union in San Francisco. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Children's book illustrator Ted Lewin loves two things, pro wrestling and painting. Coming up, Lewin tells us how he worked his way through art school in the 1950s by working as a pro wrestler. Lewin illustrated the children's books The Potato Man and The Great Pumpkin Switch. He's written and illustrated a new memoir about the wrestling life. Also, the new film A Dangerous Woman conjures up images of knife-wielding psychotic females, but it's about danger of a different kind. Film critic Stephen Schiff will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the end of a day of talks aimed at resolving the conflict in Northern Ireland, the prime ministers of Britain and Ireland could only agree to keep talking. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from Dublin.
It was a long day, 7 hours of talks, but at the end, British Prime Minister John Major and Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds could only say they had made progress in resolving differences between them. The sticking point is the language to be used in a statement of principles the two governments are drafting. It's hoped this statement will lead to a complete cessation of violence in the north. Then negotiations among all parties might begin. Language is the sticking point. Which words are used and who said them first? Neither government has been able to agree on how to write a statement that will be accepted by all sides in the quarter-century-old conflict in Northern Ireland. The men will resume their talks next week in Brussels. I'm Michael Goldfarb in Dublin.
One of Somalia's most powerful factional leaders says that General Adid must agree to a ceasefire and a UN leadership role in Somalia before other factional leaders will meet with him. Adid is also being asked to promise that his forces will turn over their weapons. Representatives of the various factions have been holding separate meetings with UN and U.S. officials in Ethiopia. In time, it's hoped that face-to-face meetings will occur involving the various warring parties. Observers feel a quick breakthrough in the talks is not likely. In Washington, the U.S. Air Force general, who was the architect of the Persian Gulf Air War, has been issued a formal admonishment by the Secretary of the Air Force. General Buster Glosson was found to have engaged in improper conduct. NPR's Martha Raddatz has more.
Glosson, who is now a three-star general, has been considered a real star in the Air Force and a close confidant of Air Force Chief of Staff Merrill McPeak. But with this official admonishment, those close to the process say Glosson's career will go no further. Secretary of the Air Force Sheila Widnall issued a statement saying Glosson attempted to improperly influence officers who were selected to serve on a promotion board. Specifically, according to a source, what Glosson did was try and convince three members of the promotion board not to promote a particular officer. Any outside contact with promotion board members is strictly prohibited. The three board members reported Glosson, and an inquiry was conducted jointly by the Air Force Inspector General and the Department of Defense Inspector General. The admonishment will become part of Glosson's permanent record. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 2 points to close at 3,704.07 on volume of more than 268 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. The Labor Department says that unemployment moved down last month to its lowest point in nearly 3 years. Officials report a jobless rate of 6.4% in November, down from 6.8% in October. U.S. businesses added 208,000 jobs to their payrolls in a number of industries. Officials say the number of people out of work dropped by 534,000, but still came to 8,252,000. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has unveiled a $25 million program to help cities cope with the needs of the nation's homeless this winter. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The death of a homeless woman outside the HUD building earlier this week spurred the department into action. Assistant Secretary for Homeless Programs Andrew Cuomo says HUD will accelerate the delivery of $250,000 to the District of Columbia for emergency services for the homeless. HUD officials will also begin meeting with local governments and homeless advocates across the nation to determine how best to use another $25 million.
And what it means to Secretary Cisneros is a more proactive, more engaged HUD, not just in the district, but in communities all across the nation.
HUD will try to convince cities and states as well as charitable foundations to come up with matching funds to supplement the federal effort, Cuomo says, in order to prevent more homeless from dying in the streets. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
White House officials say that there's been some progress in talks with North Korea, but as yet no agreement on outside inspection to the nation's nuclear sites. U.S. and North Korean officials met today in New York City. At that meeting, North Korea formally responded to U.S. proposals for solving the current deadlock over the nation's nuclear capability. The State Department said only it is studying North Korea's response and will discuss the matter with its allies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When I was a lot younger, I was fascinated by pro wrestlers. My brother and I bought every wrestling magazine that came out, and we would pore over the photo spreads, trying to learn everything about these larger-than-life men. Men like Haystack Calhoun, who weighed 650 pounds, Killer Kowalski, and the original Zebra Kids. I probably read about my guests back then. Ted Lewin was a professional wrestler from the early 50s to the mid-60s. He used the money he earned in the ring to pay for art school. As he writes in his memoir, I was a teenage professional wrestler, Renoir, Rubens, and Picasso by day, headlocks, hammerlocks, and flying tackles by night. After 15 years, he gave up his wrestling career and began work as a freelance illustrator of children's books. Although he left the world of wrestling, his affection for the players never diminished. Lewin told me that his love for wrestling began when he was a young boy.
My first exposure to it really was my father taking my kid brother and myself to the wrestling matches in Buffalo. We'd go there and watch the matches and practice every single thing we learned and watched, and my kid brother and I became, I think, professional wrestlers by the time we were, or would be professional wrestlers by the time we were about 10 or 11 years old.
Now, what did you like about what you saw there?
Well, I've always wanted to be an artist ever since the day I can remember, and I think there was something about the theater and the art of watching these guys and the wonderful athleticism. I mean, I've always been interested in that too, and kind of the combination of art and athletics, if you will, I guess, was what really attracted me. The show business, I guess.
Did your father somehow have high hopes for you and your brothers, thinking, my sons are going to make it as professional wrestlers?
No, I think it was probably the biggest surprise in his life when we started doing this. My older brother got into it first when he got out of World War II, got in the Marines, and was a bodybuilder, had a wonderful physique, and they kind of recruited him. The promoter in Buffalo, Ed Don George, they wanted a local boy, and my brother was it. My father was well-known in town. There is a retail jewelry store he had for 52 years, so the name was well-known, and here's my brother, the bodybuilder and the ex-Marine hero, and it was a perfect combination. And when he started that, my father was kind of anxious about it. My mother too. They thought he's going to get hurt. You know, they couldn't go to the matches. They couldn't watch it. It was just too much for him. And then when Brother Don gave me a call, he was out in Ohio, his second or third year in the business, and I was ready to go to art school and needed a summer job. He said, "Why don't you come out and be my tag partner?" And we were, of course, ready. Got kid brother and myself, because we'd been doing this since we were 10 years old, and waiting for my debut. You know.
Now, did you have a shtick? Did you and your brothers have a shtick? And most wrestlers either have a kind of fancy costume or they have a kind of persona that mm-hmm. they strut around in the arena.
Or they don't have anything, which makes you kind of a baby face, which is our term sort of for the nice-looking young man who is is going to be not going to do any dirty tricks, and he's going to be the recipient of the dirty tricks, and the villain is the guy that does the dirty tricks. So we all sort of look the part of the clean-cut fellow that wouldn't do anybody any harm, and we wore kind of red, at least my brother and myself at the time, my brother Don, wore patriotic red, white, and blue baseball jackets and had no real gimmick.
Now, before we go too much farther, I do want to talk a little bit about the theatrics and how much of wrestling, and we're talking back 50s and mid-60s, mm-hmm. how much of that was really a sport and how much of that was a put-on. There's a picture of you and a guy named Bill Curry, and you have
Bull Curry.
Excuse mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. You have him in a headlock, mm-hmm. and there's you have this grimace on your face. Mm-hmm. Now, are you squeezing the living daylights out of his neck, or are you just putting on a face for us?
Well, I'm squeezing him, but I don't know that I could you know hurt him any worse than he'd already been hurt over the years. No, it's kind of a combination of what you see when you see college wrestling or amateur wrestling, and that's the basis for it. And then you add all the ingredients, the things that are the things people pay to see, and that's the flying. Nobody would really pay to see, I think, an amateur wrestling match. They go because they love it and they know what it is. But the paying to see it, getting people excited, that's flying around the ring, and that's body slams and drop kicks and all the aerial maneuvers, the things that are very, very dangerous to do. Dangerous not only to your opponent but to yourself. And those are the things that need to be perfected so you don't hurt yourself. So it's kind of a combination of those two things. There's no intent to maim or kill each other. That would be counterproductive.
Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit more, but first we have to take a very short break. Okay. And my guest today is Ted Lewin, and he is now an illustrator, artist illustrator of children's books. But back in the 50s and 60s, he was a professional wrestler, and he's written a memoir about those years. The book is called I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with artist Ted Lewin, and we're talking about his years as a professional wrestler. Did you earn a lot of money as a wrestler?
Well, my brothers did because they were main eventers. They went on the road and they moved from place to place, and were always a top. Got main events. Were top men. But I was going to art school. That was my primary idea. That's why I was wrestling, to help pay my way through school. And I wanted to be an illustrator. That was my goal. Their goal was to be the best they could in the wrestling business. So that requires traveling the country and requires being 3 months, 4 months in one place and on to another, so that you're always a fresh face and you can always bring something new to a different area. But I was what they call a local guy. I stayed in one area, and whenever they needed somebody for a preliminary match or to fill in, that was me, and it was I earned plenty of money as far as paying my way through art school and paying my expenses, and it was very helpful when I left school, because starting to freelance as a freelance illustrator is a very, very tough proposition, and most of my friends had to take some kind of a job to support themselves, and I had the wrestling. A few nights a week did it.
Well, you have one of my favorite wrestlers from my youth in your book, and that's Haystack Calhoun. I guess and I was probably about 10 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. He was so large.
large is right. I remember what.
He was captivating.
We should maybe describe him. He weighed around 600 pounds, and I think about it back then, he was he was really quite young. He wasn't too much older than I was. I was 17, 18, 19 when I first met him, and I don't think he was only a very few years older. He wore his hair, long black hair, all the way down to his shoulders and a little goatee, and he wore denims, overalls, and walked around barefooted and wore a chain around it, a big, heavy chain around his neck with a horseshoe hanging on it.
Well, I remember reading what he had for breakfast every day.
Oh,
and,
God.
It was three loaves of bread, dozen eggs, boxes of cereal.
He had to go everywhere by car, all his matches, because there was no way he could fit into an airliner mm-hmm. seat. Mm-hmm. So or into a train seat, for that matter. He was stuck driving everywhere.
Did the audience ever scare you more than your opponent?
Well, there were times when the audience were pretty scary. You know the intent of if you're having a really good match, the idea is to get the crowd riled up, and it should be controlled. You know, you can kind of handle the heat. You can keep people, or you should be able to keep people during a match within some kind of reason. But something will trigger a crowd sometimes. Maybe it's the certain half a dozen people in the front row or something, but it can spill over. And I've been involved in many riots where it got really out of hand. And of course, you're in the ring naked and vulnerable, and crowd starts pouring into the ring, and it gets very, very dangerous.
So what do you do?
Well, both wrestlers sort of get—it's what you do in a shark attack, really. You get back-to-back and start flailing out, right? But usually there are other wrestlers watching this from the sidelines, kind of back in the chutes to the dressing room. When they see it start to happen, you can feel it when it's going to happen. They immediately kind of bunch up and push their way through the crowd and get near the edge of the ring. And if the crowd spills over into the ring, they push their way up, and then it becomes kind of a phalanx of wrestlers and sometimes special police and officials, whoever happens to be there that it can help. And they kind of surround the two main participants. Usually it's the villain that the crowd is very angry at, and they want to get to him. And I remember a riot once in the old St. Nick's Arena, and it was Mr. Israel, who was a wrestling rabbi, wrestling. He really was a rabbi. Yeah, and Raphael Halpern was his name, and he was wrestling Hans Schmidt, who was doing Nazi salutes and all of that. And I must say that crowd really went over. They threw whole rows of chairs from the balcony into the ring, and it was a very, very dangerous place to be. I remember some of the commissioners getting hit with flying chairs and bottles, and it was really terrible. They actually closed St. Nick's down soon after that, and I think that was one of the reasons. It really did get out of hand in that place.
Did you like the fame? I mean, the fact that you could part a crowd?
Yeah, I think that's addictive, you know. It was very hard to stop. Finally the time came when it was very hard to travel and you know, to kind of say, can you go to Pittsburgh? And I said, I can't do that. I'm working on an illustration. I have a deadline. So it got very, very difficult once I really got busy doing what I really, really wanted to do. I just had to finally ease off and not be able to do it anymore, and I really missed it. But to answer your question, yeah, the ability to be able to do a specific move and know exactly what reaction that's going to have to a crowd, if you do it right, is there's this kind of wonderful feeling of, in a way, control, but it's also very creative because the matches just happen. You know, something will come. It's like dancing. You'll try a step, and it'll work beautifully, and the crowd will love it. You'll just take off on that and expound on it, go more with it. You know, if it doesn't work, you try something else. So in a way, it's very creative. It's like painting. You know, I always saw it kind of as a creative extension, really.
Well, do you still miss wrestling?
I do. You know, maybe I should tell you about what sort of started the book in the first place. That some friends of mine one night said, you know, we know you used to wrestle, and he said, but we've never been to the wrestling matches. Mm-hmm. This is years after I stopped wrestling, and they said there's going to be some wrestling matches right nearby in Brooklyn at American Legion Hall in Greenpoint, and just the next section over from where I live in Brooklyn. They said, would you come as our guest and kind of do the local color and tell us what's happening? And I said, oh, I don't know that I want to do that. You know, I feel funny. And they said, they talked me into it. So we went. It was about six friends and myself and my wife, and we sat at the ringside, and I walked into this smoke-filled dump, you know, and I thought, oh, gosh, it's the old days. And the nostalgia was starting to kill me, you know. And I said, wait a minute, I want to see if any of the old boys are still around, you know. And I went in the back, and I said, and I remember a friend, Arnold Golden Boy Skoland, used to kind of, as they say, take care of the shows. He would arrange the matches and pay the boys and take the money back to the office, that kind of thing. And we were very, very good friends for 15 years, and I hadn't seen him in 15 years. And so I said, is he around? And they said, who wants to know? And I told him, and the guy looked at me like he was seeing a ghost, you know. Hi. Ran downstairs, and then he come running up, and he dragged me down. It was like old home week. I mean, we were hugging and kissing everybody, you know. And meanwhile, my friends are upstairs wondering, where the heck is he? He's supposed to be doing the color here, you know. And my wife said, oh, he's seeing his old friends and visiting and everything. What happened is Arnold Skoland said to me, you know, one of the wrestlers didn't show up. He said, I need somebody to fill in. He said, would you do that? And I thought, how can I do that? I mean, it's been 15 years. And then I thought, how can I not do that with my my six friends who had never seen it and my wife who couldn't imagine it sitting out there? So I live so close by, I grabbed one of the friends, swore him to secrecy. He drove me home, and I sort of ransacked the house to find my old bag with my old wrestling gear that I hadn't seen in 15 years. Ran back.
Wait. Did it still fit?
Sure, it still fit. Yeah. Oh, I stay very fit. And it was just the way I packed it away, like a museum piece, you know. And I put it on, and I had to get examined. I had to buy a New York State license because you can't wrestle without one. And I walked into the ring in the semifinal match, and my friends looked up. I'll tell you, the looks on their face, you just cannot believe. My wife couldn't believe it. And I was wrestling a guy named Johnny Ross, who actually broke in 2 or 3 years after I did, and he was kind of still at it, you know. And during the match, he threw me right out on their laps, and they never quite got over it. But that experience, I called up a friend of mine, Ed Grimm, who's a writer, and I told him on the phone, I told him my whole experience. He said, you ought to write that down. He said, that really is wonderful, and sent it into the Times. So I did that, and they ran a little op-ed piece about it, which prompted an editor at Dodd Mead said, why don't you expand on that? And to make a long story short, 13 years later, I still hadn't found a publisher for the book. They couldn't figure out exactly what the audience would be. And then wonderful editor Dick Jackson at Orchard Books said, you know, it's a young adult book. It's a great story for kids. So it took 13 years, though, to kind of find a home for it. And it all happened, it all started because of that one night comeback.
So when you were in the ring, much of the surprise to your friends and your wife, did the moves come back to you?
Like riding a bicycle.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting because we'd all been out having a big party beforehand, eating lots of food, drinking lots of wine. So it's amazing that that I didn't lose that all, as a matter of fact. But the moves, you never forget them. I could right now go in the ring and have a half-hour match without having forgotten one thing. It becomes so automatic and so natural, like dancing. You don't really ever learn forget how to dance. You may get a little rusty, but you don't ever really forget it. And I hadn't forgotten a thing.
Well, I want to thank you, Ted Lewin, for joining us and talking with us about your life as a professional wrestler. It's been a real treat.
My pleasure.
Artist and former pro wrestler Ted Lewin. His memoir is called I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about some of the news today. Noah, I understand there is news about the unemployment rate.
Marty, the U.S. unemployment rate went down to the lowest level in 3 years. NPR's John Isdey has that story. Other news, Richard Gonzalez has a report on the issue about ID cards for all workers in America. Michael Goldfarb is in Dublin, and he reports on talks between the British and Irish prime ministers and their staffs. They have been talking. There is little or no progress, really, but they have been talking, indeed, about peace in Northern Ireland. Bob Mondello talks about several of the upcoming holiday movies, and Jerry Stern concludes his series of essays about his recent medical difficulty.
Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Deborah Winger's acting career has been more notable lately for pluck and experimentation than for box office success. And the experimentation continues with her role in A Dangerous Woman, directed by Stephen Gyllenhaal, who made Waterland and the TV film Paris Trout. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
There's a certain kind of role that's catnip to good actors, the kind that involves suppressing their glamour by playing someone who's mentally impaired. A lot of Oscars and Emmys have been won that way, most recently by Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. But Deborah Winger's performance in A Dangerous Woman probably won't join those exalted ranks. It's not showy enough, not sentimental and heart-tugging enough. And mostly it's too peculiar. We never do know quite what's wrong with Martha, the character Winger plays. She seems pretty low on IQ and on the ability to connect with the real world. She wears thick glasses and dowdy print dresses and black bobby socks with heavy leather shoes. She doesn't so much walk down a street as TikTok down it. And she has manic phases, too, when she wants to buy, for instance, large quantities of Tupperware. The movie's only diagnosis is she's weird. And that seems to be the diagnosis in the small California town where she lives, in a guest house owned by her beautiful Aunt Frances. Frances, who's played by Barbara Hershey, is herself a troubled, edgy woman, but she dotes on Martha and worries about her, too. In this scene, for instance, she's concerned about Martha's relationship with a local lowlife named Getso.
What were you doing in his car?
No, that was Bertie's car.
Yeah, but you were with him.
No, I was waiting for Bertie, and then he came out.
Oh, you were waiting for Bertie, and then he came out. Now, you know, now it's making total sense. This is one of your crushes, isn't it? Has he done anything to you? He has, hasn't he?
You don't know what you're talking about, Frances. You think you know everything about me, but... You don't know anything.
I know one thing. I know you pester people, you pursue them, and you haunt them, and you've got to stop before something terrible happens.
Something terrible does happen, of course, but not before the film has stretched our credulity to the snapping point. A lot of this movie's problem has to do with the sexual relationship that pops up about midway through, between Martha and a hard-drinking handyman who shows up to do some repairs on Aunt Frances's house. He's played by the suavely handsome Gabriel Byrne, and he's a sort of literary amalgam, a bit of the gentleman caller from The Glass Menagerie, a pinch of the erotic gardener from Lady Chatterley's Lover, and snips from about 20 other famous plot devices. Byrne works very hard to convince us that his character is something more than a screenwriter's romantic pipe dream, and fails. The movie's beautifully shot. The light in it has a crystalline quality that makes everything feel like a fairy tale, except there's no magic in it. The pace plods. In fact, the only thing that keeps you watching is Deborah Winger's performance, which, like so many performances, which is wonderful, which if you can't quite make out who or what Martha is supposed to be, Winger makes you believe in her. She burrows deep, makes you believe in Martha's